All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bryce. We've got an awesome guest for you today, but I'm joined, as always, by my good buddy, my compadre across the nation, Mr. Brendan Veman. How are you doing, Brendan?
Bryce, I am doing good. I mean, like you said, we got a very special guest, and we've seen a lot of conversation about what's happening and how the world of crypto is intersecting with TradFi. So we brought on one of the best guests possible to talk about exactly that.
Yes, Mike Reed is joining us. He's the head of partnership developments at Franklin Templeton for digital assets. Mike, thanks for joining us, and how the heck are you today?
I'm doing great, Bryce. Thanks a lot for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, we're excited. You know, market's volatile, but generally things have been up and to the right. And yeah, we're super excited. But yeah, Mike, we'd love to just dive in to Franklin Templeton at a high level. You know, we see the numbers, $1.5 trillion sort of traditional asset manager, but who's also breaking into the on-chain world, the crypto world, you know, the RWA world—you could call it a bunch of different things, digital assets. But we want to start with a high level. What does, you know, Franklin Templeton do? What is their mission?
Oh boy, we do quite a bit. We build and we invest. We build directly on blockchains ourselves, authentically. We have our own team of engineers that built a digital wallet infrastructure, on-chain transfer agent, all that kind of stuff. And then we invest in the assets ourselves. We have multiple track records of different disciplines, ranging from index aware to fully discretionary and everything in between. We have a venture capability. And then we also run validator nodes on multiple chains. So we got our hands in a lot of different pots. I like to tell people, We are authentic, and our learnings have all been very organic. And by that, I mean, authentic in that we build authentically on chain. We're in it. We're investors. We're enthusiasts. We use the tech. We love it ourselves in our everyday, but then get to do some of it for our real jobs as well.
When did Franklin Templeton kind of break into the tokenization trend and on-chain management and stuff?
Well, I started learning about the first time I heard anyone talk about crypto. My boss came in maybe 15 years ago. There was a whole bunch of us who were in fixed income, in Franklin fixed income years ago. And we were super interested in just looking at different asset classes, esoteric pockets of capital, just all sorts of stuff. And he walked in one day and he said, my son was playing Call of Duty and some people paid him. He was on Stitch and he's like, somebody paid him in Bitcoin to like solve a level. Do you guys know what that is? And none of us had ever heard of it. And so we were like, let's dive in. So we started learning. And then when Ethereum launched, we started to learn about smart contracts and programmable money and all that kind of stuff. And to a bunch of fixed income people, thinking about if this, then that statements coded into your cash flows, that came super natural to us. So we started diving deeper and deeper and deeper. And then one day we were like, well, why don't we try and do a project here? We got kind of lucky that the woman who's our president CEO, Jenny Johnson, used to run operations for the company. And so the idea of ledger efficiency was something she was really psyched about. And so when we came to her talking about these distributed ledgers, she was like, what can you build? Can you use those ledgers in our own business to try and build something, you know, differentiated and build ledger efficiency into our book? You know, we're in finance, so ledgers are everywhere. And so we began the process of tokenizing a money fund at that point and launched that product a few years later.
That's crazy. It's a crazy story. You guys, you know, went from the traditional financial world to realizing, you know, more than an experiment, this stuff might actually bring efficiencies to our business. You know, we want to enhance things that we're working on, but we could enhance things for customers. So you guys, you know, really sit at the crux of crypto and traditional finance. You do many different things. You also, I believe, are in the ETF game as well. Does Franklin Templeton, manage Bitcoin ETFs or anything of that nature?
We do. We have a Bitcoin ETF. The ticker is EZBC. And the idea was making Bitcoin investing easy. My own father was really interested in investing in Bitcoin, but the whole idea of a wallet was pretty scary and cumbersome, and He didn't want another account. And so, you know, as soon as we launched the ETFs, he started investing in Bitcoin just because it became a lot easier. So our Bitcoin one's called EZBC. Our Ethereum one is EZET. And then a product I really like is one called EZPZ, which is a multi-token product that adheres to an index. And what makes it into that index are assets where there's potential for value accrual and stuff like that, but that have been approved by the regulator. So you can think of, so right now it's just Bitcoin and Ethereum in there at a market weight. But as more assets get approved and make it into that index, the portfolio will expand over time. So it's kind of set it and forget it crypto. It's like I want market beta. I don't really know what I'm doing. I can just allocate to this and know I'll have that that exposure. It's a pretty cool product. I'm pretty psyched about it.
Well, I could definitely see, you know, we were just talking the other day to somebody, and they were talking about all the Bloomberg odds for all the different altcoin ETFs that, you know, 95% to 80% or whatever odds of approval this year for like, you know, a half a dozen or a dozen altcoins. So are you saying that like if they get their spot ETF approved, then they could be maybe added to this EZPZ ETF?
That's right. Yeah. Wow. It's I hate to mention a competitor product in a public channel, but it's kind of like QQQ, but for crypto. It's like it's like an index oriented beta play for, again, people who just know they like the interesting aspect. You know, they think there's a cool space, a lot of really interesting technology, but they don't really know how to allocate. And so they're like, I'd like a market weight exposure to a bunch of different assets. And as time goes on and more assets get approved, the index will grow, and so too will the composition of the portfolio.
So I saw that Templeton has the basket or the index like you're talking about pending still, and then you also have a Solana and an XRP spot ETF that are pending. Is that the is the basket that you're talking about right now that one that is pending?
It's live, actually. It's live now.
Wow.
Yeah, we have a hat somewhere that say easy peasy with a lemon beside it, because so I thought easy peasy lemon squeezy was kind of a fun thing. But yeah, it's approved and available. I mean, I buy it myself. It's approved and available.
That's awesome. And then you have a couple more that are on the way. I guess walk us through the mindset here, because now what we're seeing is that a lot of asset managers are exploring beyond Bitcoin, beyond Ethereum, and they are creating these baskets or these indexes where they can encompass all of the products that they get approved for in the future. And there really is just this push right now to get other altcoin spot ETFs approved. I guess, why is that and what's the interest there?
Yeah, so I'll say this. I can't comment on an ongoing filing with the SEC, but I would say that to me, there's kind of Bitcoin and then everything else, kind of, not really, but you know, Bitcoin's got its own investment thesis that I think is different than a lot of the rest of the space. And I think a lot of the really interesting things that are happening in the rest of the space. A lot of the really interesting projects that are being built on the protocols. And like I said in the beginning, I actually use some of the products myself. So like Helium, for example, I'm a Helium subscriber. I use the phone. My phone is a Helium phone. Helium is the service provider. Yeah. So I enjoy the services as a subscriber, but then I also operate a hotspot out of my house. So, you know, I can earn doing that. Token exposure, Solana exposure broadly. I think that DPIN narrative is like still interesting and I think super relatable.
Yeah.
That's something that a lot of people in crypto really don't think that much about for when it comes to talking to traditional investors. There's a real translation function that has to occur where things we do in crypto are things that are done in traditional finance in some cases. They just look slightly different. So for example, you know, burning tokens kind of feels like a share buyback. It's not quite the same, but it kind of feels that way. Think about paying out validators for doing the validation work. That's almost kind of like reinvesting in your business or paying to secure the network. But you know what I mean? It's like when you start to think of it in those kinds of terms, we've noticed the lights really turn on for a lot of traditional investors. And I think some of those things that are happening in DPIN really let people say, oh, there are real businesses. There is real cash flow. There's real product here, real interesting ways of doing things. So I like using the products because I like trying it all out. I like seeing what works, what doesn't work. Really, I have one of those, Cudis, the rings. I have one of those. I'm wearing it right now. So you can like mint your own healthcare NFTs and really fully realize, the economics of that rather than having a third party sell your data if you choose. So I like trying stuff out and seeing what works and what doesn't work. So anyway, point is, sorry, back to your question, which was like altcoins in general in the space. I think a lot of those things that are happening outside of kind of Bitcoin, even Ethereum, a lot of the things that are happening in the altcoin space are really interesting.
If you have been considering futures trading, now might be the time to take a closer look. The futures market has seen increased activity recently, and Plus 500 Futures offers a straightforward entry point. The platform provides access to major instruments, including the S&P 500, NASDAQ, Bitcoin, natural gas, and other key markets across equity indices like energy, metals, forex, and crypto. Their interface is designed for accessibility. You can monitor and execute trades from your phone with a $100 minimum deposit. Once your account is open, potential trades can be executed in two clicks. For those who prefer to practice first, Plus 500 offers an unlimited demo account with full charting and analytical tools. No risk involved while you familiarize yourself with the platform. The company has been operating in the trading space for over 20 years. Download the Plus 500 app today. Trading in futures involves a risk of loss and is not suitable for everyone. Not all applicants will qualify.
I'm no tech genius, but I knew if I wanted my business to crush it, I needed a website now. Thankfully, Bluehost made it easy. I customized, optimized, and monetized everything exactly how I wanted with AI. In minutes, my site was up. I couldn't believe it. The search engine tools even helped me get more site visitors. Whatever your passion project is, you can set it up with Bluehost. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, what do you got to lose? Head to Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com to start now.
Yeah, like even recently, Bryce, I know we were just talking about this, but you've seen a lot of different players want to get involved in altcoins or want to get involved in crypto one way or another. Yeah. JP Morgan was just talking about it. Bank of America was just talking about it. Robinhood came out yesterday and said, hey, we're going to be launching our own chain on Ethereum so that we can tokenize assets. And there's just been a lot of discussion, whereas for a while it was like it started out as, we don't want to touch crypto. And then it was, we want to look at Bitcoin. And then now we're kind of entering into the next stage of that is, how can we not only offer altcoins, but how can we use this technology and get plugged into the ecosystems, which, you know, you all are doing here. You guys are all actively in stage three and doing this. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating because I think everyone has, crypto is so vast, so that everyone has a little bit of a different approach as to how they want to use it and how they see it fitting in to their own like agenda and like a good way.
I think like so that kind of progression you talked about, something that kind of hit, do you remember like a couple minutes ago I said we're authentic and organic? I didn't choose those words by accident. When I said organic, what I mean is all of the learnings kind of build on each other, right? So like you hear about Bitcoin and you're like, what's that all about? And then you learn about Ethereum and what's that all about? And even when it came down to chain selection, so our money fund is called Benji. The token is called Benji. It's an authentically tokenized money fund that's available. You can download an app. I think it's called Benji Investments, and you can download the app, KYC your way in, and then buy a money fund token. One token is equivalent to one share of the underlying fund. So when I say, again, like organic. So we were looking at this and we're like, okay, what chain should we launch on? And we were trying to decide, looking at all the chains, we want to do it in a regulatory compliant way. And so we launched initially on Stellar. And one of the reasons we chose Stellar as our launch partner was because Stellar at the time, things changed, but at the time didn't have any smart contract capability. And it felt to us like, from a regulatory standpoint, that was just a cleaner story. Okay. So we launched on Stellar. But when we're choosing the chains, you start to learn some of these chains, they have different like transactions per second, certainly different cost structures available. And so you start to say, okay, well, if all these chains have like slightly different cost structures, are there people who are interested in them for different reasons? And then you start to learn about the communities on them. And so then we start saying, okay, well, we want to be available wherever those communities have a desire. So we started expanding. So then we went live on Polygon, Aptos, Avalanche, Arbitrum, ETH mainnet, Base, and then Solana a couple months ago. And so you start expanding to go to where the users are. And
that's
then
where all the users are. Nobody's well, on Stellar.
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to be in as many places, but again, like meet people where the demand is, you know? And
right,
then and then you're like, okay, so these tokens, like the price of them moves around. Are these investable assets? And what happens if I just equal weight them? What happens if I use like factor based investing? What happens if I just have like a infrastructure thesis or whatever? So you start to learn all these things and how the assets move over time. And what becomes super apparent to you the deeper you go is how not only is this asset class big and it can't be ignored for that reason alone, right? Like it's a huge asset class. It's bigger than US high yield. So you can't ignore it on that reason alone. But then you say there's really compelling narratives in here for me to want to invest in. So that like altcoin thing that you mentioned is something that became apparent to us right away, like really early on. So that's why we started building track record, you know, just to kind of build on looking further and further out and seeing what else there was available to invest in.
It's so cool because, you know, you guys are like a traditional financial firm, but you're not just focused on like tokenizing treasuries or, you know, whatever, you know, you're doing that, but you're also doing so much more in the space and kind of really rolling up your sleeves and, you know, making this stuff from the ground up. And so, yeah, I like that organic and authentic sort of motif throughout everything that you do. But I want to dive in specifically to that money market fund on Solana. You guys chose Solana primarily because of its speed and security, or what kind of went into the thought process there with Solana?
Yeah, so I would say with all the chains that we launched on, and Solana is certainly like exemplar of this, is that we have two kind of basic frameworks that we look at. One is a tech suitability framework, which is available in our prospectus. It's something codified into the way that we build. So just make sure the technology works for us. And then the other thing that we look at is kind of a business development suitability framework. So like I said, like meet the users where they are. Are there enough things happening on this chain where we might be able to integrate with different projects where it makes it kind of like, you know, you don't want to just dev on a chain and then have it live with no assets because you know, you paid to have that work done. You want to be able to have, you know, different economic opportunities present themselves, I guess.
Yeah.
And one of the things that became really apparent to us early on, like the, again, like this organic thing. By the way, if these answers are too long-winded, feel free to say like, hey, man.
I love them. No, they're great. Okay.
I get kicked under the table at cocktail parties like all the time by my wife, who's like, hey, nobody wants to know about this. But we're super excited about it. So, you know, when we launched the money fund in the beginning, yields were at zero. And so really no one cared.
Right.
And what happened was rates started to back up. And right as rates were backing up, Silicon Valley Bank failed. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of Web3 natives who had treasury at Silicon Valley Bank, and they didn't want to park it in a small regional bank again. And so what happened for us is that people knew we were developing in the space. They knew we had engineers. We weren't just tourists. And so they were like, would you guys take our money? Could you hold on? You know? So we developed this like thought exercise, for lack of a better term. We developed this like really thing that we were high-fiving about, but no one cared about. And all of a sudden everyone cared.
Yeah.
So, but what became apparent to us really early on in that journey was that this is not a money fund. If you talk to people about this, like I work in partnerships. My sales is not in my job title for a reason, because we're not selling a money fund. We're talking about a tool that can be used in different ecosystems. So we started thinking to ourselves, okay, if people are going to use this as a financial tool, what kind of functionality do you want? Because there's a million money funds already in the market. They all work with the existing systems. It's a totally commoditized space. So how can you differentiate yourself? Why is it being on chain important, other than the fact that you have a new customer base, which is great, but why is that an important thing? So the thing that makes it important is that if you mint authentically on chain, so we don't use a third party to go on chain, we do it ourselves. So the asset authentically lives on chain. There's no off-chain book of records that we have to reconcile with, which means things like transferability can all of a sudden be coded into your asset. So we did that. We coded in transferability where users could send it to other users. So we had a user, you know, we have a large multinational that invests some treasury capital in
like
our
whitelisted
asset
users, basically.
Yeah, to other. Yeah, yeah, correct, correct. They move money around to opcos in Benji because historically all these opcos held money in money funds, and if they want to move money from one entity to another, they have to sell out of a money fund, transfer the cash over, and then reinvest in a money fund, and that can take like 3 to 5 business days where you're yielding nothing.
Yeah, it's a lot of friction too.
So much friction. And now you've not only removed the friction, but their money's always working for them.
Yeah.
Right? They're fully realizing the economics of their trade because it's an instant transfer of a yield-bearing asset that they wanted anyway. Mm-hmm. We had a VC investor who asked us if they could fund portfolio companies in Benji tokens. We had a group who wanted to make a payment to a vendor in Benji instead of doing it. I mean, shoot, I have literally been out for drinks with a friend and paid my share in Benji tokens using the mobile app. So this transferability thing was something that we knew had legs immediately, and we sprinted towards it and added that in the asset. We've also added other functionality too. So we have a USDC on-ramp for our institutional investors where they can buy and sell the product with USDC through a third-party facilitator. We are working on some other functionality. The thing that I'm the most excited about, again, like I'm a fixed income person for a couple decades before crypto. So the thing I'm the most excited about, which we just announced within the last 2-3 weeks, is a function we're calling intraday yield. And what it means is that if I transfer you that asset at noon, I accrue yield from midnight to noon. You accrue it from noon to midnight. And then at the end of the day, because our fund pays every day, it doesn't just accrue daily, it pays daily. So when the airdrop of new tokens occurs, we each get it proportional to how long we held the asset. Now, if you and I go out for drinks and I transfer you tokens, it's not that, you know, it's like 10 bucks, I don't know, 20 bucks of yield for a few hours. It's not really that big of a deal. But if you start to think about the institutional use cases like collateral, repo, trade finance, you know, situations where sometimes people hold $10 million on their books for 4 hours a day, every day, but they don't own it when the market closes, so they couldn't realize anything in that. Now they can get 4 hours worth of yield. And over the course of a year, that adds up pretty significantly. Yeah. So we actually have a patent pending on that technology because we're like super psyched about it. That only comes because the asset lives on chain and you can cut the rewards up to the block. We say to the second when we're talking to people, but this is crypto
to us. Yeah.
Yeah. Blocks. Yeah. Right. Right. So we can block cut it up time. to the block, which, you know, and that yield clock runs 24/7, 365. So you transfer the asset on Sunday morning at 2 a.m, it settles authentically at 2 a.m. And then you can do that intraday yield calc to figure out how much yield you would get over the course of the period you held it.
It's crazy that this didn't happen faster, because when you think about this, you're like, it's 2025. Like, this is the future. Like, why can't I send a transfer Sunday at 2 a.m. if I want to, right? Why can't it happen instantaneously? Why can't it happen cross borders? Like, why can't we have all this stuff happen? And, you know, the answer now is like, we can. And it seems like this super clear like solution. But you know, I think in the past, you know, regulation did get in the way of parts of this happening. And I'm curious just to get your take on like what is happening with regulation. And if you think that the US framework is evolving fast enough to support tokenized products, or I guess even like how this regulation impacts or impacts something like Benji, for instance.
Yeah. So I got a whole bunch of thoughts on everything you just asked. One is just to like level set. We actually took the approach with the regulators of being collaborative and not combative. Mm-hmm. So when, and I'm not just saying this because this is recorded and is going to be published, but truly we felt like it was much better to like go on an educational journey together and learn together. So when we launched our products, we actually worked in conjunction with the regulators on them and educate them on everything. We had, you know, kind of a strategy around communicating with them and things like that. So we never really had like a problem with the regulators. It's more just like, let's learn through this together. I think it's an apolitical statement to say that the regulatory environment today is a lot more favorable for crypto than it was a year ago. That's just level setting. I think some things like, you know, like Stablecoin Act, that kind of stuff. We kind of, so let me say this about Benji in particular. With Benji, we are not trying to blow up the banks, right? Like we are not anarchists. We are, we have a huge, you said like $1.5 trillion that live on those rails. So we're not trying to blow up the banks at all. We are also not trying to blow up stablecoins, because stablecoins provide an essential service in this ecosystem that our asset can't provide, because we are a permissioned asset. So we have to know who owns every Benji token at all times. We have to know those users. Stablecoins KYC at the point of mint and redeem. There's the underlying for Benji is an SEC registered 2A7 government money fund with a ticker, a very traditional vehicle. It's a security. It's a digital asset security, Benji is.
Yeah.
So it's much, much different than a stablecoin. So we kind of think about like if stablecoins are your crypto checking account, Benji can be your crypto savings account.
That's
money can move freely between those two things, and one provides an essential service. Well, I would argue both provide an essential service, because people want to yield on their assets and people want to have their money always working for them. Like I said, fully realizing the economics of your trade. That to me is a huge part of the ethos of crypto.
I got a question on all this to this point. You know, why do we even need to have two separate things? Why can't our USDC just automatically bear interest for us? Why do we need to have to go from USDC to Benji in order to get that yield? Why can't the USDC, which is already backed by short-term government debt or whatever, why can't it just automatically flow through to holders?
So I'm not a securities lawyer, but I think if you start paying out that income, then you start bumping up against securities regulations. Mm-hmm. And the key difference here is a stablecoin is a stablecoin. Benji is a digital asset security. So things like KYC controls are deep in place for us, and they aren't necessarily as stringent for stablecoins. So they're kind of, I totally hear what you're saying, and they're kind of two separate things right now.
Yeah.
I mean, in the future, who knows? But I know people
can't have our cake and eat it too.
Maybe not yet, or not now. But you know, I think that's something that a lot of people are looking at, and I think codified into the legislation is that stablecoins can't pay yield. So
right, yeah.
Yeah, so
you can't like automatically be yielding or something.
Yeah, I think that's because then all of a sudden they start to bump up. They start to look more like a security.
Mm. Okay, interesting. What do you think about that, Brendan?
Yeah, I mean it's fascinating, especially when we have so much going on, especially in regards to stablecoins. I think that's the part that's fascinated me the most here lately. With the Genius Act going and being like at the forefront of conversation and seeing how people want to interact with that. And just also the reaction that we've seen from the TradFi markets. And immediately, I think it was when it passed the Senate like a week or two ago, when that happened, we saw a huge reaction from, it was JP Morgan, Bank of America. There was one other. And then even, Citibank. I think it was, who was it?
I think Citi. Yeah, they all announced they're like doing a stable coin together.
Yeah, and then I think Amazon and one other player also came out. And it was just like companies, like, you know, financial giants, everyone all of a sudden was like, hey, if this goes through, like, it's the green light. And
Uber, I saw as well, alluded to including stable coins into their application too. It's probably going to just end up being as easy as Apple Pay. Like, I use Apple Pay for everything. You know, you double click on your iPhone on the side, and then you just have your cards loaded in there. You'll probably just have like your wallet just in there already.
I think. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree and say, I think what Mike has said so far, and probably what you're about to say, helps everyone understand like the pros of this and why it's happening and why it's being used. And again, back to just the original point, like it seems like a logical decision, and you've made a great like point for this already.
Well, I mean, you know, let's remember one thing about stablecoins. If there's no adoption, then no one will care. So the you have to find use cases for the stablecoins. You're right. There's product. I mean, there. Quite frankly, there's been product proliferation in the stablecoin space for quite some time. I know the U.S. regulation is relatively new, but this is a narrative that's been told for a long time.
Yeah.
And what we found is that there's people who have created new stablecoins where those projects have taken off because there's tremendous use cases for them, and then there's others that have not. And usually it's something like the asset can be used in pair trades. There's, you know, spending venues for the asset. There's all these kinds of things. And so I think if you're going to, like, saying you're going to launch a stablecoin is one thing, but having a real business strategy around it is a whole other, you know, ball of wax. And you have to figure that second part out before you can launch it with confidence. Because quite frankly, I think there's a lot of people who already have that business strategy set up and are you know, have built successful ventures in that space.
Yeah, no, I love it. I'm curious. Do you see the world kind of evolving more? Like, I feel like there's two pathways, and maybe we'd probably go down both pathways. Pathway one is like centralized companies, kind of like what Robinhood announced, like basically trading, you know, stocks on chain 24/5 or whatever, but you're like doing it through like this permissioned world. Mm-hmm. Or do you kind of see like this other world unfolding, like where you're trading, you know, tokenized stocks on Uniswap like permissionlessly, and other sorts of, you know, products that are, you know, and assets that are issued by folks like yourself, or the team?
I'm going to say a little from column A and a little from column B. That's kind of a cheap way, but it really feels like there's both worlds have evolved. You know, people are exploring institutional DeFi right now, and I think there's a lot of really interesting things happening there. Again, going back to that idea of translation function, the looping strategies feel to me just kind of like leverage, which, you know... Yeah. So not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying, like, that to me, like,
it's,
I look
called
at
spade
that,
a spade.
Immediately you're like, oh, I know what that is. You know, a lot of these constructs. So, I think, you know, figuring out what to do with these kind of permissioned assets in some of those permissionless spaces, and a lot of people are sorting that out right now, is going to be kind of a next big hurdle for large institutions like us to get involved in that space.
Yeah, no, it makes a ton of sense. And like, do you think that like people are going to be having more and more wallets, or do you think the banks are going to be integrating wallets and people aren't even going to really know about it? Like, I'm just kind of curious, like, what you think about from the UX perspective, how people are going to be most interacting with crypto. Is it like going to just be under the hood? They're on Bank of America. They don't even realize they're using crypto. They're just, you know, having a better, you know, experience, 24/7, 365 access to their money and their assets. Or is it going to be like they're going to be on different newer wallets and platforms and stuff?
So borrowing from my colleague Sandy Call, who's the head of innovation at our firm, Sandy's long had a thesis that the wallet is the account of the future, and all of these assets can live alongside each other. And I definitely, not just because we work together, subscribe to that thesis. I think that, you know, and I've heard different people say things like, when everyone just thinks this stuff is money, that's, we'll all be a lot better off, but, you know, about it. But I think it's not just going to be invested assets or investable assets. I think it's going to be other things that are living alongside those things. Like, you have an NFT. So like Sandy and I were both big Pearl Jam fans. So say you have I like Pearl Jam. So say you have like child of the 90s, but say you have like a Pearl Jam NFT that might give you royalty rights, maybe a meet and greet with the band every year, you know, the new album, like whatever it is, say it gives you all these kind of benefits. I could keep that alongside my Solana tokens. I could keep that alongside my tokenized equities or whatever I end up holding in that portfolio. And then all of a sudden you start to think about all these assets. So like, let's go with the Pearl Jam example again. So let's just say, like, I've met the band a bunch of times and I'm satiated. I think that, you know, I've had that experience. It was great. And I could, you know, figure out, is there a market where I could lend this NFT out and someone else could borrow it for a fee and they could have the band experience? Again, I mean, I think this is the third or fourth time I've said this, but like fully realizing the economics of your trade, right? Like you're right. Like, okay, I own this. It's a cool thing. And there's other people who might not want to lend out their Pearl Jam NFT or, you know, pick whatever it is. The sports team that sells an NFT to, you know, like the Green Bay Packers shares, you know, that kind of idea where you could lend that out for some kind of benefit. I think all of these assets are destined to live together. So I think for advisors, traditional financial advisors, thinking about asset sourcing is going to become paramount because they're going to have wallets on chains where they can source good investment ideas for their clients alongside things that investors are passionate about. Because the what we've seen over time is the investor desire to have assets that mean something to them emotionally is consistently going up over time. So people care more. They want to feel good about something. You know, my kids have, stock accounts. And I'm like, what do you like? And they're like, I like to eat here at this restaurant. I like to eat at this place. And so
like
we buy
play
stock.
This game.
Exactly. So that's kind of how. So now think about that from a grown-up perspective. Maybe you like really like, you know, a certain asset. And you also think that the company's got a great chance for growth. Now you're investing something you're passionate about where you think there's going to be good return. So I think all of these assets are kind of destined to live alongside each other in a single wallet.
You know, the conversation of wallets is interesting because I agree. I mean, it does feel like the future. One of the hurdles that I would like to see solved is how do we have this balance between security and making it, I don't know if accessible is the right word, but people get scared.
Convenient.
Because they say it again.
I was gonna say like the trade-off between like security and convenience kind of thing.
Exactly, because that is the biggest gripe that I see from people who aren't super deep into the weeds of crypto. They go, a wallet seems either complicated, or they get scared with the fact that if they don't remember their seed phrase or they don't write it down and store it somewhere the proper way, that they could lose everything. And I think that idea makes them nervous, even though, you know, in a perfect world, it is more secure. It is the best. Like, it is this brilliant solution. But I think that people realize that sometimes that they can be irresponsible and they view that as almost a security risk because it is inherently more secure, like, if that makes sense.
No, I know what you mean. It's like the fear that, you know, you hear a story, it feels like I hear stories all the time of somebody who threw away their thumb drive.
Yeah.
You know, like with a Bitcoin on it. So like, I totally get it. So I would say two things about that. Number one, I think that you can just use the ETFs, right? Like, again, totally. We didn't name them easy by mistake, right? You're making life easy for people. But then number two, I think like there is always with any adoption of technology, like there's time until that technology gets accepted and more broadly used and things like that. Now you could argue that to someone like my kids, having to write down a seed phrase is like my oldest is 16. So you could argue that for like my 16-year-old having to write a seed phrase, not a big deal. He doesn't really care. You could also say he has nothing. He has no money. He has no assets. He's broke all the time. He has to borrow money from us for gas. So like,
and I'll never let him forget it.
You can't. So you could argue like someone who has nothing has a very low risk if they lose their seed phrase.
It's a good point.
But I think over time, a lot of these things will become institutionalized and that user part of it is going to become, the experience is going to become a lot better.
And I'm sure in the early days of like the internet with like passwords and all this stuff, people probably got the same kind of scare back then. Sure. They're like, hey, this is new. What do you mean if I don't remember my password or something?
You
I
think
lose
people,
access.
Yeah, nobody wanted to put their credit card on online ever. I remember those days even.
Yeah. Sure. And there was nervous about that.
So like it's totally for our Benji product, I'm not trying to sell you a money fund, but for our Benji product, it's we have biometrics, right? So like it scans my face and then logs me in once you set it all up in the account. And what's happening in the background is that we have spun up a wallet for every client. Every client gets their own wallet on chain. So that you're kind of like obscuring that seed phrase portion of it with our wallet infrastructure. So like I said, like I think a lot of the UI for this stuff is going to change over time. But man, I really think one of the best things that anybody who's never experienced this space can do to learn about it is like the great thing about it is these assets can be cut up in these infinitesimally small amounts, which means you don't have to have a lot of money to try things out and just see what works for you. You know, I think my first crypto cap was maybe $500 or $1,000. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a ton of money at the time. It felt like a lot, but you know, it was not a lot of money. It was just like, let's see what this is all about and see what happens here. And then the first time I went out and I bought an NFT, and then I moved it from the provider's wallet to a different wallet. And then there's this period where it's like not sitting in any wallet and I'm freaking out like, oh my gosh, I just lost that. And then all of a sudden it shows up and then you learn, oh, the block had to be written, right? That's what was going on there. And so you learn these things by doing it over time. It's not just like investing in something where you're like, I can feel the volatility, so I understand how the asset performs. It's also understanding the underlying tech and why these things are good. That really helps you, feel good about not just investing in this space, but participating in it as a user as well.
Totally. It helps you kind of strengthen your conviction too.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I've got one final question, because we were just talking to Matt Hogan from Bitwise the other day, and we were asking him what he thinks about the future of the ETFs, because so far, I mean, the Bitcoin ETFs have gone down in history as like the most successful ETF launch ever. And my question to him was like, can we continue to see that same level of adoption and growth and inflows? Because it seems like it's been monumental, but is that something that is A, sustainable, or can B, actually increase from what we've seen so far? And his response is, we're actually anticipating it to beat last year's record this year and then beat this year's record next year, and saying that he thinks that the adoption curve is going to continue to improve and surpass what we've already experienced. At Franklin Templeton, what do you all see? I guess, what are you all expecting in terms of adoption and just overall performance when it comes to these digital assets?
The assets or the ETFs?
The ETF like inflows.
The ETFs.
So I don't know if you're familiar, but there are these filings called 13F filings, mm-hmm. where you can see who owns the assets. But there's a cutoff where if it's an advisor that manages less than, might be 100 million, I can't remember what the number is, but you don't get to see who it is. If you look, the vast majority of ETF assets are owned by that unknown bucket, which is like, people like me. You know, I buy our ETFs through a retail brokerage account, and there's nobody advising me on that. It's not advisory business. It's just I buy them, retail users buying the ETFs. I think there is a huge potential for growth here when you start to see the advisor community start to adopt these assets in overall portfolio models, thinking about optimization. We've actually gone to great, again, old fixed income person. I was raised on correlations, efficiency frontiers, sharp ratios, like all these investment metrics, right? It's kind of what I was raised on. And you start plugging these assets into some of the, and to figure out what the metrics look like. It turns out the investment metrics historically have been really good. Yeah. So it's really a question of like any asset. It's really a question of how much volatility are you willing to assume for the reward that you're getting for that volatility. Am I getting paid for the vol I take? And then how much vol am I willing to take? I guess is another way of putting it. And I think, and we have papers put out about levels of allocation that people should have in portfolios and things like that. We think that as the traditional investor community continues to adopt these assets and look to them as a way to invest in really exciting new novel technologies, there's tremendous potential for growth.
Somewhere between 1% and 10% is the right allocation, you think, for kind of the average? You know, I guess there's no like typical person, and of course nothing's financial advice, but how do you kind of pair it? You know, I know I saw Rick Edelman, who's a big wealth advisor, said up to 40% for, you know, more risk seeking clients of his.
I saw that as well. I'll tell you, I am a raging crypto bull. This is my career. This is, but it's also my passion and my interest. And at any point in time, our family's net worth sits somewhere between 5 and 10% in crypto. Because as much as I love crypto, I love knowing that my kids' 529 plans are funded and knowing that I can make my property tax payments. Knowing that kind of the things I need stable cash for are going to be able to be serviced. So
Fixed
that's
income
not, what's
guy.
that?
Fixed income guy.
Yeah. I mean, sure, you could say that and say like maybe I don't have an appetite for volatility, but like I have an appetite for a lot of volatility in certain parts of my portfolio. But again, like I don't want to not be able to afford my house because I bought something super volatile and it went down a lot in a year. So, I think we're actually, if you look at the, and I don't know what some of our official models state, but I'll tell you this. If you look at efficiency frontiers, like Markowitz efficiency frontiers, these are like classic portfolio theory things. You get a significant lift in your portfolio from a risk and return perspective by just including 1%. And there's a lot of people, take 1% out of equity and put it into crypto. You get a really nice pop in return for a really small pop in volatility. And if you think about just nominal risk, like if it goes to zero, what happens to my overall portfolio? Fine. If you think about just like the stomach risk, it's 1%. But you have to remember for investor portfolios, and I think when you hear people like say massive numbers in terms of allocation, you have to remember volatility of returns directly trends into volatility of relationships. I mean, I hear a lot from my dad. When Bitcoin is over 100, I hear more from him when it's under 100. And like, you have to remember, this is kind of the way, and I didn't give him any advice. He just did it, right? So like, this is the way people have to understand is that if people are making investment advice and recommending huge allocations, when the volatility comes, how good is that relationship? And is that relationship going to abandon you because you recommended a massive allocation of something that's supremely volatile? So anyway, Bryce, way too many words to say what you already said, which is there is no typical investor. Everybody's got their own risk return appetite, and you kind of have to figure out what fits for them.
No, you totally nailed it. And I love the explanation. And it kind of makes me, and this is, by the way, this is why we ask the pros. We want to hear from them. So take as many words as you feel like you need. But really what I'm curious to get your insight on, and you've also been in crypto for a long time, there's this thing called the 4-year cycle, right? Where we've got the halving. Every 4 years there's a halving, and it drives liquidity and it drives supply from miners and all that kind of stuff. But like we've never had, and there's a big risk in markets saying this time is different, but like this time is different because we've never had institutions. Like we've never had these ETFs that have, billions and billions of dollars of flows. We've never had, the Morgan Stanley Wealth Advisors and the Wells Fargo Wealth Advisors like start to come online and say, yeah, we're gonna be able to pitch Bitcoin ETFs. So I get, and this is kind of in a sense also like lowered the volatility. Like we've talked about like the volatility, like each cycle, every 4-year window, the volatility is less and less and less and less and less, and probably will be over time. Is the 4-year cycle done now that we have these new market structures?
I mean, no, it's a real thing, right? Like it's coded into the asset, so it'll happen. But to your point, I think it's really anytime you see more participants enter a market, historically what you've seen is volatility goes down, return potential also can go down. It's harder to replicate the returns that you've already received when asset prices start to go up. So you see that kind of behavior with every asset that exists. Almost every, I shouldn't say every because I haven't studied every asset under the sun, but like generally speaking, that's something you see. More market participants tends to equal lower volatility.
No, I'm very curious to see how it plays out and if the October slash November sort of market top that's projected by these 4-year cycles stays in, and then we're going to be in for another correction of a year or so, as it typically is. But who knows? I know one thing's for sure: Crypto 101 will be still there, reporting on things, and I'm sure Franklin Templeton will still be building things, bull market or bear market. Man, Mike, we really appreciate kind of bringing you on. Is there anything else that we didn't ask that we really should have? Maybe anything that you're building, any strong opinions that you or the firm have that we kind of didn't dive into yet?
Well, I mean, I kind of mentioned everything that we do. We have this investment capability. We have everything we build on chain as well with our Benji products. We also validate as well. We operate 11 validators, 30 validators across 11 different blockchains. I think what you're going to see over time is more people taking a much more comprehensive approach because all these things feed into each other. The fact that we operate validators means that when we have our product living on chain, we have our own copy of the records. It also means that we have all of the data on that chain. So if our analysts want to use that data in the analysis of the chain and come up with a price target for the token, we have it all ourselves. We don't have to buy. So the chains inform that. If you invest in an early stage chain and they're like, we're going to need validators eventually, we have that service that we can help to offer if it makes sense. If they say things like, oh, we could really use help with our coding. Like, we feel like it's good, but we're not 100% set. We have our own team of engineers that can help with that. And all these things relate to the engineers talk to the analysts when we're trying to decide what chain to go on next. We talk to the analysts and say, is there actually something happening here? Is there a real movement going on, or is this just, is it a zombie project? So I think you have to have this kind of comprehensive approach to the space to really understand what's under the hood, which will come to, eventually lead to better outcomes for your clients.
Totally. There, I feel like I read a study, and I could be hallucinating, but I think it was done by Franklin Templeton. It was about transaction cost savings, like $50,000 for 50,000 transactions, and then 50,000 transactions on, I think you guys used Optimism, it was like $1.52, and so the math was like a 30,000 times efficiency in cost. Was that your department that kind of did that study?
We don't actually publish the cost savings we've achieved by running things on chain, but suffice to say it's pretty, and we're not on Optimism, but suffice to say it's pretty intense. It's the kind of thing where we put this money fund on chain, and then we have someone's gonna get really mad at me for not knowing this, but we have a whole bunch of these specialized investment managers that specialize in different disciplines. So like, real estate, private equity, private debt, traditional equity, all these different things. And when we had the cost savings data, we went around to the CIOs of all of these different investment groups, and to a person, the reaction was the same, which was, how do we do this sooner rather than later? Like that's too intense of a cost saving to ignore. So I think, and look, there's a lot, like anytime you want to change the transfer agent for a fund, there's board meetings that have to occur, there's filings that have to occur. So it's actually a pretty heavy lift to be able to put funds on chain. We started with Benji, we started with a brand new fund structure and a brand new fund board specifically because of that, because it is quite a lift. But to anybody, it's apparent the cost savings are so intense. Moving assets on chain seems to make a lot of sense.
Love it. Mr. Mike Reed, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us all things about digital asset partnerships at Franklin Templeton. We hope to have you back on again soon. Talk about some more updates, anything that's kind of going on in your world that the good citizens of Crypt Nation should be hearing. We'd love to have you back on, and thanks for coming.
Love to be on again, and thanks for having me. Appreciate it.